Call the meeting to order.
Need something. Okay, the president. This continues our considerations of the various versions of proposals of House Bill 550, relating to unemployment insurance. And before we go into some of those proposals, I want to address a matter that was asked about on Thursday and Friday of this last week. On Thursday, Mr. Hayes asked some questions. I didn't really understand where he was coming from the questions, because I had no are you my new administrative assistant, Mr. Hayes?
Is he missing?
Oh, well, that's his chair. We do let him sit down.
Is he here?
A few burdens. Oh, he's off. So he's way over high. During the Thursday morning meeting, Mr. Hayes asked some questions regarding the contracts that the department has with the various unions. Then on Friday, he gave me a letter requesting that we refer or request the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to look at the practices of the department in actually carrying out the arrangements that they have with the unions. We're supposed to reduce administrative problems. We have long job hunting lines and people are attempting to get unemployment insurance. And I responded to that orally then and yesterday. I've indicated to him and some of the other people who signed that request who are on this committee that for right now I would prefer to follow the procedure. It's my view that if there's some claim that somebody's violating the law or it's not being administered right, that may or may not address the way the law is written. The crude example is that if you say murder is illegal and somebody commits murder anyway, it may not necessarily be a good idea to rewrite a statute that defines what murder is. On that premise, I'm hoping that we will proceed anyway with our considerations of House Bill 550. If members of the committee have any amendments that might make it easier to enforce certain portions of the law with regard to fraud or anything of that sort, or managing the contracting procedure of the Department of Labor with the labor unions, we can do that. But when and if we ever get this bill out of the committee, we only have a couple of more relatively small bills to get through, and the Senate has not deemed it necessary to pass very many bills so far this year. So far, we only have one Senate bill. It would be my intention at that time to take up those questions and to see what this committee can find out about it, to determine whether we should make the indicated request of legislative budget and audit. Mr. Hayes?
I didn't go ahead and finish, Mr. Chairman.
That's basically my statement. Go ahead.
Well, as I told you yesterday in your office, it's my opinion that we ought to at least hold a hearing now with members of the Department of Labor to explore some of the allegations that I made in my memorandum that was signed by some of us and given to you on Friday. My opinion that if we bring some of the people in from the Department of Labor and ask them some questions, we might uncover some problems that ought to be addressed in this piece of legislation. I would hate to pass out the legislation out of this committee, hold a hearing, and then find out that there's some problem we should have addressed. So, Mr. Chairman, I take exception to your suggestion. I think that before we act on this bill in this committee, that we should, as a minimum, hold a hearing on one or two meetings and bring in members of the department, possibly some people that are involved in the administration of the sign-up slips with the that are working for the union and try to see if we can't get to the bottom of it and possibly address some problems that might develop through some additions to the legislation we now have in court.
Well, since you made your request to the department on Thursday, I presume that they expected the issue to be raised here at least somewhat today, and I did intend to ask some questions about it today. The legislature does have to adjourn sometime, and I don't want to delay consideration of the bill in the committee. It still goes to one more committee, and this is still the first committee referral. We sat on the bill partly with the result of the governor's request in his cover letter in May of last year. We were then told that the governor would have a sponsor substitute available, which was finally available, I think, on the day or the day before when we brought this bill up in March. So it has been a month since then. So I'd be interested in following up some of those questions today. I don't know if I'm going to spend a lot of committee hearings on it or else whenever the bill is
ready. Well, I'd like to ask Mr. Jones some questions today.
Sure.
Appropriate time to.
I think that we would like to talk to some of the representatives of the department on this subject matter. And if we ever get to the bill, which I hope we will be meeting tomorrow evening at 7 p.m., by the way, we'd like the members to take a look at this, which is passed out. It should be on your screen of folders when you're looking at it, probably going into Wednesday evening. And apparently we're going to meet Thursday morning also, Thursday morning's meeting, and that shows the differences in contribution rates among current law, the proposed draft CS is in front of you, the sponsor substitute. I guess we're not considering the original bill. I request the administration because there are some errors in this up to correct the sponsor substitute. In the meantime, Mr. Spear, I don't know how you want to traffic cop the people from the Department of Labor on this question, and I did not know that there were questions of compliance. Have you seen the memorandum that was circulated by Mr. Hayes?
No, Mr. Chairman. My name is William Spear with the Alaska Department of Labor. We learned about the situation, particular situation, I guess it was the commissioners up in Fairbanks and made the front page of the news minor or something. But we are aware and have been aware of these problems attending the work search for union members. And there are some very substantial practical problems, which we would be very happy to have the committee look at. And if they feel that there's a better way to do it or a more efficient way or whatever, we'd be more than happy to follow whatever guidelines. The basic problem, I think I mentioned in our original presentation on House Bill 550, was that in our law, through the federal law, in 2385, suitable work is defined, and it basically states that no work may be considered suitable and benefits shall not be denied, so on and so forth, if, as a condition of being employed, the individual would be required to join a company union or resign or refrain from joining a bona fide labor organization. Mr. Finley, we had some agreements, they weren't pre-statement, but they were back in the early 60s. Last spring, encountered not so much abuses, but we just wanted to look into the whole situation again and make sure that everything was being accomplished because it hadn't been looked at for 10 or 15 years. And we met with Mr. Carlson and a whole room full of union representatives from around the state. They had some objections to our redrafted agreement, although the final agreements that were entered into are almost identical. There were some statistical material that the union representatives weren't interested in collecting for the department, which is understandable, perhaps. The other problem was on the, as I remember it, was on actual signing of the slips that we'll get into, if we get into the problem is, I don't have the citation here, but there would be criminal sanctions for a person signing or assisting someone collect benefits improperly and so forth. And they apparently did not feel that under the circumstances, which are rather extreme in hiring halls, that they wanted to take that kind of responsibility upon themselves to assure that out of a list of 5,000 or 10,000 people that Joe Blow was there sometime that week. And I think that the only provision that was knocked out was one that they would assist the department in rooting out people who were fraudulently claiming benefits or something like that. But Bert, could you give us an outline of what the practical problems are and what would happen if we didn't have the agreements?
I'd like to ask Mr. a couple questions about the agreements. A couple of points that I raised in the memo that I gave Mr. Brown on Friday. One had to do with a facsimile type signature, rubber stamping, in lieu of the or signature stamp instead of the signature is set forth in the agreement. And another had to do with provision in the agreement that says that the division will periodically monitor the validation process with respect to the union's availability status from ADSB 1201. First of all, going back to my request on Thursday, I had previously asked from the department for copies of the agreement between the union and the Department of Labor, and I received about 11 agreements.
I'd like to ask about that. Interestingly enough, the request was made Thursday morning, and the committee never received it. I don't know why Mr. Hayes would have received it.
Oh, I did not receive it since Thursday morning, but previous to that, Mr. Chairman, I had my office had called the department and asked for copies of agreements of all the agreements with the union, between the unions and the Department of Labor, and those were delivered to my office on, I think, Wednesday. And then I raised the question again on Thursday. And Thursday, I haven't received anything, to my knowledge, since Thursday, since I made that request. But the stuff, the material that I received on Wednesday, I considered as incomplete. First of all, there were about 11 agreements. Some of them, for instance, one of them was with the Carpenters Union, but it was just a local. There are several Carpenter Union locals, and there was only one agreement. I didn't see any agreement between the Department of Labor and the Teamsters. That was given to me. I know that there are many locals within each union, and as much as there was agreement from the local of one union, it would lead me to believe that there should have been agreements with locals of the other, you know, with additional locals. So that was the reason I raised the question on Thursday. I didn't had reason to believe that wasn't a complete list, either that you didn't give them all to me, or that in fact the department doesn't have agreements with everybody.
Mr. Hayes, I was the one who responded to that. There was also a cover note to come over with these union agreements, which was sent over a week ago today because your secretary picked them up from my office. And at that time it said I did not have all of them, particularly from the Fairbanks area and from the Anchorage office. They hadn't been forwarded since that time, and I apologize, I have several in my office that would bring over to you, which includes a statewide agreement from the Teamsters and also some agreements from various other unions. The Fairbanks was the area that was missing, and it appears that the local office manager had not sent our copy down to us, or it went into a file and we couldn't find it. And we're still waiting for copies of all of these from Fairbanks. I haven't received all of them from Fairbanks. I've received some from there and some from Anchorage. And these, I do have several on my desk, which I did not go to the office this morning before I come here, and I apologize for not getting them, but they will be brought over to you.
I didn't, apparently I overlooked the transmittal letter, all right.
It was just a cover note of Representative Hayes that I sent saying that it was not a complete list.
The other question, Mr. Chairman, I mentioned was in the memorandum, Friday's memorandum, two points raised. One was the signature facsimile. The other was the question is to what extent the Department of Labor was monitoring the validation process. And in that regard, Mr. Spear, do you have any knowledge whether the commissioner or yourself as deputy commissioner have sent out any memos or any type of instructions to the divisions that would establish a monitoring procedure? Is there any, is there such a...
We haven't sent out anything that I could think of as a procedure. We wouldn't get into that kind of a detail of management, though. As far as monitoring, I know the commissioner monitored the laborers hall yesterday in Fairbanks to see how the situation was going, but we can't really get into that kind of a detail. This is the responsibility of the division. But
shouldn't the commissioner's office establish a procedure for the division? I mean, or make sure that there's one established?
Well, in the same sense that all power in the department comes from the legislature through the commissioner, yes, I certainly bear responsibility for the proper prosecution of our statutory mandates. Bert, do you have a procedure?
Yeah, the monitoring of these union agreements is left up to the division, up to our investigating unit, Representative Hayes. And as I think you fully aware that we are very short staffed there, and they monitor on a hit and miss basis because they just don't have the staff to go out and monitor every union hall. You take the number of union halls in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and they're trying to do their regular work of catching fraud, and the priority is not monitoring the union halls. We just do not have the staff to go out, and they have been monitored some, and of course all we do go in is monitor the 1201 process to see if it's being handled properly. And in relation to the 1201s, we have two procedures. It's an experiment in a way. In Anchorage, the unions have the stack of these 1201s, where they do use facsimile signatures in some offices. And then as the people come in, they stamp and hand them out. In our Fairbanks office, the local office issues to the claimant when he comes in, picks up his check, they issue him a union certificate, the certification slip, and he takes back and gets either stamped or signed. And the facsimile, we will admit that the facsimile signature probably is not the best thing in the world, but the unions have stated when they have 5, 6, 7, up to 1,000 people going through their offices and their hiring halls in one day, they just don't have the time to sign all of these. And of course, we can prosecute the claimant regardless of what's on this union certification, whether it's a signature or a facsimile. True, I think we'd have a hard time coming back and prosecuting the union for the facsimile signature. But it's really been a matter of expediency, and if the legislature, I think that they would so see fit to direct us or order us to use signatures, like it does state in the agreement, we would have to be getting back with the unions. But could Mr. Carlson might be able to respond to this? This is just really an added burden to them. And we feel with, particularly, we are probably going to go statewide issuing the slips at the local office to go to the unions, because we feel we have a little better control on that.
I think a couple of things that might be said at the outset of the background. These are agreements that were entered. These are not some sort of, we don't have dictatorial power to insist that essentially private parties, unions, follow some procedure. They are negotiated and agreed to, and hopefully both parties can get out of them something valuable.
But aren't...
It's give and take on both sides. The question is, putting yourself in the shoes of, say, a dispatching agent in Fairbanks, you have a room jammed with people. You have a dispatching agent sitting behind a window, and there are two jobs for 10 days in Mount McKinley. And the position that you apparently are asking for, that this dispatching agent sign and make sure that he knows everyone in that was there to make sure that they were there, you know, when you consider the criminal penalties that are possible for the dispatching agents, he's not going to be very willing. He's not in any kind of practical position to really take on that kind of responsibility. And I really have to sympathize with that person's problem.
Mr. Chairman, I don't, I don't see how that's any different than what we're doing here. We're establishing two classes of citizens. There's the citizen who doesn't belong to the union. He goes down to the labor department, stands in line, and they handle the deal. They there's a guy who goes to the union and
that
picks up a slip.
Is because of legislation. There are no regulations, or we're trying to comply with Alaska Statute 232385, which says that makes this distinction, creates two classes, which is reasonable when you look into the practical aspects. Another couple of points I'd like to make. It may not be a proper assumption, but my guess would be in that hiring hall I just mentioned that the 300 or 400 people that are in there are probably all drawing UI. I think what Bert was saying, I'm putting our effort where we're actually going to be making money at it. As an individual matter, it's important, but as a schematic or program goal, sitting here, I'm really not too concerned whether number one on the list or number 43 or number 243 is collecting UI, because somebody's going to be collecting it. If there are no jobs, period, or just two jobs, okay, maybe number one should have taken the job, then that puts him at the bottom of the list for a 10-day shot at Mount McKinley or something, and there may be other reasons why he didn't take that job.
I think you're saying something that I was going to, you're alluding to something that I was going to ask you about, and which is something I had heard that, as a matter of fact, the number one guy on the union list that's supposed to go to work quite often doesn't go. For some reason, that's worked out between himself and the business agent, he elects not to go to work. When a job comes up, maybe the job isn't to his liking, maybe he'd like to extend his vacation or whatever. And I think you're alluding to the fact that somebody down the line, other than the number one guy, goes to work. And I find that interesting because I wasn't aware that the department was aware of that situation.
Well, in our previous conversations with you, I think this is one of the things we talked about. And you know, from a self-righteous standpoint or from a moral or program integrity, yes, I agree with you. The number one guy should probably take whatever job comes down the line. But in terms of saving the fund any money, somebody's going to take that job. I've never really seen any jobs that were available go begging in these situations. And it may be that there may be some differences, but we then get to the question of, well, what can we do about it? What would we do, for instance, in the absence of these agreements? We would, and I think Bert would want to explain what the alternatives are, and if you have a better suggestion about it, we'd be glad to hear it.
Mr. Arnold, the more I hear from you, Mr. Spear, the more I begin to believe that there is necessity for an audit. And you know, I don't think we care about your philosophy one way or the other, just whether or not the laws of the state of Alaska are being followed. And, you just can't turn your blindly turn your back on a situation that may not be right.
Well, I would welcome an audit, Mr. Anderson. Short of an audit, any suggestions that the committee would have of how to improve the system. We have three investigators, and there's no way that they can go in and monitor every local at every call. Some of them don't even have calls. They have operators that don't use telephone dispatches. And I'm at a loss to know how to conform to the legislation, frankly, in any kind of practical way. And I am not...
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. Anderson.
The function of the audit would be to assist you or the legislature make recommendations on what could be done. And if a procedure isn't set up, and I haven't seen it yet, but a set of procedures that you have developed. And it seems to me that it ought to be in some kind of written form so that everybody understands what's going on. But an audit would give us the information that we need. We need to make a recommendation on how to help resolve the situation.
Well, we would be willing and able to assist your auditors or anyone else that's interested. Mr. Carlson, we had rather extended talks about this, and there was a lot of heated controversy and so forth, but Duane may be more familiar with what the position of the unions is in this, and whether and under what circumstances they are willing to agree at all to this system.
Just a moment ago, Mr. Finley was going to respond to your comment or question about what would be the procedure if these agreements were not being used with the unions.
Yes, sir. We have been in contact with other states, and I realize that we are not going to operate like other states do, you know, but sometimes we use these guidelines, and Mr. Simon has just returned from a meeting back east, and so I'll relate all of these. First off, we could, if we cancel the union agreements, force every union member to register in our local offices. Now, that means we would divert services from our limited staff from serving the people that really need to be served, because these people have to come in and have a full-blown registration. If you're talking about 20,000 people all over the state dropping in on our local offices all at once and starting to register, this would be an impact to us. Then if they did register, I don't think we would be serving them very much, because they are union members, they are union attached. The jobs available, there would be very few of them referred to. The unions would still have the calls for any union calls. They wouldn't be going through our local employment offices. So this would force us into what I feel a very bad situation. The other thing we could do, what we're looking at, many states right today do not register their union people, and they do not register many other professions that are in drawing unemployment insurance. They only register what they call demand occupations. And these are occupations, and it's by area what is demand. For example, in Juneau, it would be clerical, it would be some of the service. Any jobs that the employment service has jobs for, these people would be required to register with the employment service. The rest of the people that are drawing UI are not required to register because they're not being serviced. Now, this is being done in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington right today, for example.
It's not clear to me how that works. What does happen to those who don't register?
They just come in and draw their UI, and that's it. They can't service them. They can't get them jobs. There's just no jobs available. And the unions people report to their unions. The unions in Oregon and Washington bring their updated union book in, which shows they're a current member, and this is all that is required in the states of Oregon and Washington for a union member. And in some of the other states, Mrs. Simons might relate to this. She just returned from back east and was talking to some other states, and they just registered demand occupations with the Employment Service. The rest of the UI claimants, they just come in and they file with UI, and they're not required to register for work. You can expound on that a little bit, Doris.
Yes, at any point, if the decision is made that each individual, there would be perhaps jobs available to them at any point, they can be required to register. But the issue is that with a very limited labor market, there's no point in forcing all these people to spend their time and staff time when there are no jobs available. So at any time the labor market shifts or changes, whatever occupations may be required to register. They do register as such, as a part of their filing for unemployment insurance. But it's an informal registration that is used as a resource in case the situation does change. They can go to those informal registrations and call those people in and request a waiver.
How much flexibility under current law and under any one of these versions of 550, how much flexibility does the department have in varying these procedures? Do you feel, say, that you would not be able to go to the Oregon system unless we were to change the law, or can you under current law?
We could do it under current law. I'm not advocating that we go to the Oregon system.
No, I'm just using that as an example.
Yeah, no, under our current law, we could do this. All I'm trying to point out is that the union members are demand occupations, are not demand occupations during the winter. There's just no jobs for them. And so we're not going to serve any useful purpose by making all of these individuals register for work with the Employment Service. And this is why we're using our union agreement, which many states don't have this much of a formality. They just use the book and assume that the man is on the list and goes to the hiring halls. We are at least requiring the individuals to report to the hiring halls and to see if there's any jobs available. And like Mr. Spear stated, Commissioner Orbeck was in Fairbanks Labor Hall, and this was a true fact. There's two jobs available, about 200 people in the hall. So the jobs did not go begging.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I can give you a good reason why these people ought to go down to the department and go out of form like everybody else. I think you say they're going down and there's no work, but we've set up a situation here with this agreement and the use of a facsimile signature that I think anybody can see such a good scene for fraud. I think that I know from discussions that I've had with the Attorney General's office in Fairbanks that there's probably a very high incidence of fraudulent claims that are fostered by this procedure that the division is allowing with the unions. You're setting you say, well, we can always if a guy fills out a form fraudulently, he can always be prosecuted. I submit he can't, because when he's caught and it's found out that he collected unemployment compensation when in fact he wasn't available for work, he can simply say, well, I went into the union and they said there was no work. And so you can ask him, well, who did you see in the union? He said, well, I don't know. It was this guy whose name is on the then you ask the guy whose name is on there, whose facsimile signature it is, and he says, I don't know. I didn't stamp it. So you're right back to your whole case winds up in a rubber stamp pad. You don't have a case. And I think that we're setting a scene here that that encourages fraudulent claims. This is the reason, Mr. Chairman, that I thought we ought to get into this before we proceeded too far with this bill, because if we have legislation, if we have laws that create two classes of citizens, as far as I'm concerned, I think we ought to do something about that. I do not support any type of legislation or any laws to where one guy is treated differently than another. And I think this is a situation that's existing in this state, where one guy can walk into a union office and pick up a bunch of slips that are pre-stamped and file a claim with very little effort, or have somebody else do it for him, where the ordinary guy who doesn't belong to a union has to go through quite a bit of work and effort to collect his unemployment compensation. And I don't think this is right.
Mr. Spear, I don't have the copies of the documents that were delivered to Mr. Hayes. I've never see anything except this blank union certification agreement. That is what I'm looking at. I presume that there's not a wide amount of variation among the contracts. Is that correct?
They're all identical. One is just...
Okay.
John, can I ask a question?
No, not yet. I haven't answered mine yet.
All right.
Mr. Spirit, if you needed to, how would you enforce this agreement?
Mr. Chairman, we seem to be bouncing the same question back and forth. We're enforcing it the way...
No. I'm asking on a different level. This is the age of full disclosure, and you and I can disclose to everybody that we're a couple of those hated high priests called lawyers. And so within that context, asking the question, not with regard to the other matters, Mr. Hayes.
Well, I think what Mr. Hayes has pointed out is that the reason that we do things the way we do is in the legislation, and it's the federal legislation that requires it. In other words, I haven't gone into any research or any way of change. There may be some way that you could get through a conformity hearing and modify the situation. But you know, it's almost like the bill itself that we're talking about. We bring something up for review and try to do something with it that hasn't been touched in 10 or 15 years, and then all of a sudden we're accused of suborning fraud or cutting off people that need UI. Frankly, under the circumstances, we're doing the best we can. If there's
Mr. Speer, I was asking you a very careful question, not with regard to your defending the department, but rather just the way this contract is written. If I were a union VA or secretary treasurer, whoever is carrying the water in a particular union, and I had heard this committee's deliberations, couldn't I say, fine, this thing's totally unenforceable anyway, I'll just tell the department to go stuff it, and we'll carry on our union business in our hall. We got enough problems as it is.
Well,
isn't it true that there's no consideration that supports this contract at all? And it's not a contract, as far as I can see. It doesn't even read as an enforceable contract. It's a memorandum of a procedure between the department and the union, and that seems to be all that it is. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but isn't that the situation?
You can't force someone to sign something. If
this is signed, I'm saying it's an unenforceable contract because there's no consideration. So it's not a contract.
I would agree. It's an agreement. It would state be an agreement. I was speaking of the slips. If the individual behind the window doesn't feel he wants to subject himself to criminal prosecution because he doesn't happen to know everybody that showed up for that call personally, I wouldn't sign it myself. And then get back to the practical problem. We could take a very hard line. We really want to see. We think there are a lot of jobs out there and that there's a lot of fraud and these people are collecting UI improperly when they could be working. If we really felt that there were that situation, we could, I suppose, say, okay, no agreement at all. We'll take them and talk to them. Problem is, let's say we get a job and let's say we're right. We say, okay, pal, there's a job out here at the Tennessee Miller, somebody's got one, take off, or else don't collect UI. And he points to the statute and says, I can't take that job, it's non-union, my membership would be prejudiced by taking it. So we're just chasing our tail here, and I think the situation that we're in is not perhaps the most desirable from the integrity philosophic integrity of the program, but as a practical matter, I think for the most part it works, although there may be individual people might not be lined up. I think the end result amounts to about the same thing. I don't think we're going to save any money from the unemployment insurance fund by changing the system, but if someone else has an idea, I'm happy to try it out.
Well, the reason I was asking this question is it just seems to me that the department is not paying the unions to provide this service that relates to a service that's provided by the department. Therefore, there's no consideration, there's no bargain for exchange between these two parties. And it seems to me that this is a memorandum of an understanding regarding the procedure. And I think
it's a recognition of the practical problem that we have and that they have. Their members benefit, as Mr. Hayes points out. They don't go through the same intensive job counseling and for no particular reason, which would turn out. We, on the other hand, are not burdened with the entire union membership of Alaska, which is considerable.
I'm just saying that it's entirely likely that if the department were to go in and complain greatly about this, the ultimate trump card for a union would say, fine, we don't have to do this. We can use some other procedure. You're the ones who are stuck with enforcing this program and providing this program. And if somebody's making accusations at us, we can just, this is unenforceable anyway, we just tear it and walk away. At least that seems to me like what they can do.
Yes, I do. Well, just a comment on that, Mr. Chairman. I submit that that regardless of the lack of consideration, which you say doesn't exist in this agreement, I submit that the union likes this. I submit they wouldn't like not to have this agreement.
If they heard this meeting, they might not like it. But go ahead.
So I think that I think they're happy with it as long as they're working it the way they want to work it, which is the way it's. On the one hand, you have an agreement that says one thing, and on the other hand, you're doing something else. So I think, Mr. Chairman, that given that set of facts, you're very comfortable with the existing situation. The question that I wanted to ask was regarding. Unions in the lower 48. Do we have a similar agreement with some of the unions that come out of the lower 48? We're thinking about some of those that came up to work on the pipeline, for instance, and I guess there are others, possibly in the fishing industry. I don't know, but do we work the same system down there?
You mean in the South 48? No.
With people that are coming to Alaska to work that are from unions, for instance, the pipeline union that when it came out of Oklahoma.
If they establish a hiring hall in Alaska and have a dispatch facility in Alaska, then we sign agreements with them at that time, yes, sir.
How is a union guy that's now down and has gone back to Oklahoma that worked on the pipeline or whatever, how does he collect unemployment benefits from the state?
He's required to follow the rules of that state. In other words, if they have an agreement like this, which most of them do not, and he follows the rules of the state. In the state of Washington, the state of Oregon, he would just bring his union card into the unemployment insurance office and draw his UI.
So there are even two different systems, we're even operating two different systems with unions. It is working in the South 48, for instance. A union guy does go into the...
He doesn't have to go into the employment office. He just goes into the UI office. He does not have to go to any union hall. And we can, you know, he's supposed to go. Well, he has to go. We tell him to go register with the union.
Right.
But he just goes into the unemployment office and presents his card and says, "I'm registered with 302 or whatever."
And what happens? Did they ask
and
him?
And then they just ask him if you're registered with the union, and he says yes.
They don't ask him if he turned down any work or.
They ask him, but there's no check with the unions or anything else to see if he does. He's not required to bring any certification slip in from the union office. There may be some states that do this. I don't know of any that have any union certification slips like ours. Ours is based, this one here is based from the early 50s in the state of Washington.
So we really don't have any check on the system and on the union guy in the South 48. We can pretty much take his word for it.
And what the local office says, yes, sir, because he is required to follow the rules of that state.
This kind of fits in with your observation that maybe the unions like the agreement. Frankly, you know, assuming that they're interested in the easiest possible way, maybe the presentation of the book without the slips at all would be, that's the case in most states, would be more agreeable. This is really one of the more strict type of procedure.
I think the point is that regardless of how the guy, what he presents to who, that the department has a responsibility to make sure that, you know, that guy is on the up and up. And that's where we started here a few weeks ago with discussions about the inability or of the department to investigate whether or not a lot of these claims are fraudulent. We're apparently trying to administer a $70 million plus program with three people, and regardless of how it's done, I think the point is a good point is that even with the present union agreement, it's apparently either not being monitored or it's just being ignored. Apparently, it's being ignored because I haven't told you anything you didn't already know. You knew that that the union wasn't complying with the agreement, yet nothing's being done about it.
I think that to be fair to the department, they are administering it with more than three people. They said they have three people serving a particular function in ESD, so that wasn't an accurate
statement. Talk about investigating.
Ms. Smith had a question here for about 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has anyone any evidence of any fraud, any hardcore evidence? Nothing has been presented to me this morning to really warrant the discussion that we're getting into. I feel like we're talking straight theory, and I kind of like to get back to the bill and go into a little more investigation of is there fraud after we've done something.
Mr. Chairman, if you want to find out if there's any evidence, check with the Attorney General's office. Check with the Attorney General's office in Fairbanks, for instance, and find out if they found out any instances of fraud. I submit they have. I submit they've also not only found out, but they have made the department aware of it. Check with your Employment Security Division up there. Check with your investigators.
If I may, I would like to see this evidence before we continue with the questioning, because I think that comes first. I don't know what we're working with, and I think it's important for the committee to have that first.
I think you're right.
Well, I agree, Mr. Chairman, but I going back to my initial opening statements, I don't think we should proceed with this bill until we've shook out some of this stuff, because I think there are some points that we may want to address in this piece of legislation.
Mr. Hayes, unless you can come up with some specific things you mean by a point, something you can show that would involve an amendment to the bill. Now you're talking about finding out whether certain practices you're theorizing about are really happening. You know what they are, therefore you shouldn't be able to come with an amendment if it applies to the bill. But right now we're in the 100th day of this session. This bill was introduced last year. We were asked to sit on it for a while by the administration. Pretty soon this legislature is going to adjourn. Unless your intention is to kill the bill, I would like to start marking up the bill tomorrow and Thursday.
Well, Mr. Spear alluded to the fact he hadn't, when I said this was in the federal law. There may be some way of getting around that. We've also discussed the possibility of withdrawing from the federal system. Those are the type of things I'm talking about. If to be under the federal system, which I have reason to believe, or at least I think it's been expressed, or isn't really all that beneficial to the state, we are encouraging and fostering the creation of two classes of citizens, then I think we ought to get out of the federal system. If we don't want to do that, then we ought to look at some way to get around that requirement so that we can accomplish it without withdrawing. But that's the point I'm trying to make. But I don't think we ought to let the situation exist.
I don't know if the people from the department have any comments or replies to the last series of questions colloquially, and that last colloquy. But
I would like to take exception to the insinuation that we have not looked into the matter, that this whole union agreement system lay completely dormant for 15 or 20 years. We took the opportunity to look into it last year and went through a great deal of strife with negotiating agreements. We're still experimenting with different ways to approach the problem, if any. And frankly, I don't think that any of the material or discussion would have come up at all had we not done that to begin with. And I'm sorry that we haven't come up with the perfect answer or an answer that's satisfactory, but I cannot agree that the department has done nothing in this regard, at least while I've been there.
Mr. Chairman, I think if you, to satisfy a question that was raised by Representative Smith, if they get Mr. Jones before this committee and ask, he's the chief investigator, ask him some questions regarding whether or not there have been any fraudulent practices and possibly get some people down here from Fairbanks so we can get an answer to this thing.
Do you think that if we did that, that we would find that those practices are anything different than the ones you're saying are potentially available under this procedure?
I think he will confirm that those practices exist.
Well, then if he only confirmed that they existed, how would he be giving us any more information than we have now for the purposes of marking up this bill?
Well,
if you see some a procedure that is has a potential for fraud and you're concerned about it and you believe that you can address it through an amendment of this bill, how much more information will you have if somebody comes in and says, yes, sir, there have been examples of just the kind of fraud you're theorizing?
I think we've only, my point, Mr. Chairman, is that my comment was in response to a problem that was raised by Representative Smith, and I think that addresses it. And the other point is, I think that maybe this is only the tip of the iceberg. We ought to take a look at the whole thing, and that was the purpose in giving the memo asking for an audit.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we'd be willing to, for the purposes of drafting or revising or adopting regulations or whatever it might take, the theory, and we're aware that there are situations that arise where this type of activity may or may not take place. But ultimately, whether it's there or not, we're going to need some approach, either statutory or regulatory or in the agreements, to deal with the problem. And we would be more than happy to work with Mr. Hayes on any suggested drafts or ideas that he has in that regard.
Well, I'm not going to dismiss the subject completely. I do want to get back into it for various reasons. My comments and questions to Mr. Hayes have been probably harsher than they should be, because of course it's properly within the jurisdiction of this committee to find out how the laws are being executed. But at the same time, I'm concerned about the timing of this bill, and I think that we are in a way addressing two different things. As long as we know what kinds of potential fraud we're worried about trying to avoid, whether they are ones that can be addressed by a change in the bill, current law, or urging the department to adopt a procedure or regulation it does not now have. I believe that, I think that's the case. As long as that is, I think we can proceed to discuss the bill, and that we will be discussing these matters after the consideration of the bill along the lines of my suggested procedure that I mentioned an hour ago that I thought Mr. Hayes agreed to yesterday.
Mr. Chairman, we do have some tag ends of homework that we owe you, which we can do briefly or in any kind of detail you want. The first one, we wanted to present the revised schedule for the benefit schedule, which we...
Oh, it fits the chart.
Right, it fits the chart, gets over the dependency allowance problem. Janet, do you have that copy somewhere? Then we also have the sheet with some observations on the difference between the federal and the state system that Mr. Hayes just referred to. Bert, you have that. Bring us a
why don't you stick one in Mr. Osterman's spot?
Yep.
He had to go to another meat kitchen. While the stuff's being passed down, I wanted to partly apologize to the committee for the necessity of an even meeting in an hour. Everybody's familiar with the way scheduling attempts are in the house right now. We'll try to hopefully that can be the only meeting we have to have. But I would appreciate it if the members of the committee would be in March 7th.
Mr. Chairman, before we leave the previous discussion, are you saying it is not your intent to continue the examination of this of members of the department, Mr. Jones, for instance, in regard to the allegations we've been discussing until after we've dealt with this bill? Is that?
That's correct, unless you can give me some good reason, we'll find out something we don't know now the latest in marking up the bill for this testimony.
Well,
Well, I think part of the, you know, part of the purpose of that is that, you know, is to find out things, and to tell you in advance what we're going to find out, I think, would, you would have to admit, is not...
Well, you know, Mr. Hayes, you did have 1 month of consideration for this bill, and you could have raised these questions earlier. And I think the committee would like to see the bill worked on after all of these, this theorizing and discussing. If you have some specific example or information on how we're going to find out something we don't know now for the purpose of legislative drafting, then yes, we will ask Mr. Jones. But otherwise, we'll look at it probably next week, and we'll probably go into some detail on it, presuming we pass some version of 550 by then. A couple of minor bills probably won't take very long.
Well, I again, I would... at this point, I think we deal with legislation that would eliminate this present two-class system, and possibly we may want to, if the department cannot establish regulations and guidelines to properly monitor this system, perhaps we ought to do it by legislation.
Well, I'm sure the committee is interested in any amendments you have, Mr. Hayes. Okay, Mr. Spear, could you...
We've discussed in general terms the difference between the state program or dropping out of the federal program, and these really, the question is so amorphous and broad that it's really almost impossible to come up with an exclusive list or a complete.
We only asked you for an overview anyway.
But these are some of the figures that we can walk through. They're fairly brief. Bert, you want
to... Okay. The first thing that would transpire if we opted out of the federal state unemployment insurance program is we would lose our administrative dollars, which for this year is approximately $16,081,000. In addition to that, the employers would lose their FUTA, which is the Federal Unemployment Tax Credit, of 2.7 on $6,000. They would be required to pay the full 3.4% on the first $6,000 of wages, whereas now they pay 0.7%. In dollars, this means they would pay $204 per employee on the first $6,000 of earnings versus the $42 they now pay, for an additional $162 for each employee that earns up to $6,000. This 0.7% is equal for the trust fund, or for the administrative dollars, is equal to $10 million. The 33.4 is equal to $35 million. At this time, the $10 million is returned to the state in administrative dollars. That's part of the $16 million. If we opt out of the program, the full $35 million would go outside of the state to fund other states' administrative dollars. As I said above, the Alaska employers, now it shows they only finance right at this time 61% of our administrative costs. The rest comes from the 0.7% that other states pay into the for the administrative costs.
I interrupted. It might be a little bit misleading here if you look at this FUTA tax as being the only tax. In addition, I think what we're talking about when you talk about switching systems from the federal to a state is what kind of a tax base will we have? I mean, what's the, how much will the market bear for an employee tax, which, again, may be a dedicated fund problem, I don't know. But what we're saying here is that you just write off $200 a person, and so your tax base for running the state program is going to be $200 in addition to whatever the state tax would be to support the new state program. You don't get anything back for the $200. You don't get any administrative funds or any of the other things. There's no provision in the federal law that if we don't do it, they will. If we don't do it, nobody does it. So the first, I guess what the committee would have to ask initially is, and we have some charts that we're looking at to propose tax rates and so forth, and they range from the present of about $400 to $100, which we'll get into later. But there remember that the Alaska tax is added, I mean, that's what primarily everybody pays now, and that amounts to about $400. So let's say we kept that amount of tax and we dropped out of the system, there'd be a $600 tax, approximately, or $604 tax. That's really confusing. I'm sorry if I'm not very clear on it. I'll be glad to answer.
The other areas of concern outside of the initial fiscal dollars is that at the present time, our agency is responsible for certifying individuals for seat eligibility. And if we did not have a approved program there, how the feds would react to this, there may not be anybody to certify CETA eligibles, so the CETA program could be in jeopardy. The WINFRO program, which is a work incentive program, is in the same area. We received $16 million, there's $770,000 that go to the WIN program. In addition to that, the welfare, health and social service, we received a share of WIN dollars. This would also be in jeopardy, so the total WIN program in the state of Alaska would probably be down to two. The state would no longer be involved in a wage combining program, which is where individuals who, say, come to Alaska and they've worked in Oregon and they've worked in Alaska and they can combine their wages to draw a higher amount of benefits, they would not be able to use the wages from another state because we would be out of conformity. We would not be involved in the interstate UI program, so if you wanted to pay benefits of any kind to an individual left the state of Alaska, you would have to pay him or he would mail a mail directly. You could not use a local office in another state because the feds would not allow this. And like I said, the wage combining, we would not be allowed to do this either. Any of the federal or military that resigned or quit or retired in Alaska could not draw our benefits. The feds would have to set up some kind of a benefit structure for them because they would not be eligible to participate in our program. Also, when the President's Welfare Reform Act comes down, and we really don't know in this time what form it will be, but it will probably be in a block grant for the governor or something like this, many of the dollars going into this block grant will come from the FUTA tax, and this could jeopardize the Total Welfare Reform Act for the state of Alaska. There's no concrete evidence of the, you know, what how it would be, but this is things that could transpire. And there could be other federal revenue that would be in jeopardy because of this. It hasn't been explored totally what it could be, but since it is a federal program, the feds could look very at us with a very jaundiced eye and probably do everything they could to cause us problems.
Thanks. It would be a fair comment to say that there's rather substantial pressure in the United States to nationalize the system or federalize it. I think at the last count, 22 states were completely bankrupt. And the question that arises in my mind is...
You mean state funds?
Right, state trust funds, right. Let's say we take this bold step to create the state system, and then they federalize the program and raise the taxes even more than they are now to bail out the other states or whatever, then we're kind of stuck with a new system or those higher FUTA taxes for which we would get nothing, but also have the additional burden of carrying the state program. I think one other halfway approach that I've heard is to just provide the absolute bare minimum that you can get away with in the state system. The minimum benefits, minimum tax, and just whatever you can skid by with, and then have a supplementary state program on top of it, which there might be some advantage to that. You might want to look into it. I think that it would be such an affront for the state to pull out of the program entirely, and I just say this off the top of my head, frankly, but I just can't help but feeling that there would be some resentment in Congress or some of the committees anyway, and whether there would be quasi-retribution in other programs, I don't know, but I think that's what Bert was getting to on his last sentence. So one possibility might be to just really skid by as low as you can on the federal system, conform and do everything necessary to stay in the then have a supplementary benefit to be paid out of state.
Okay, any questions with regard to this federal compliance question? Any question whether we deserve to have a state funding? Even with all the difficulties you're talking about, I think it still is something worth exploring. And the way things are going now, it doesn't look like it's something that this legislature is going to spend a lot of time on. But I may well end up asking either the Research Services Division of our agency or the Legislative Council to prepare a substantial work paper on it that would probably go into a lot more detail. In the event that were done, I'm sure that they'd be requesting cooperation.
Yeah, I think it's an idea well worth exploring, and I've gotten interested in it casually from time to time, but I haven't had the time myself to get into it. I think you might work out some kind of arrangement where you would not discriminate against non-residents, but where the claims would be given in-state in conjunction with job counseling or whatever, where the person would actually have to claim the benefits in person. I think as a practical matter, you would get a much higher percentage of your money circulating in Alaska. But there are some constitutional issues and federal.
Okay, we have now about the proposed changes suggested by the department that came and rushed to us last week, I believe, on these two pages here that show rate schedules. I presume this is what goes with this new chart that you gave us, is that correct? I wonder if the department could testify with regard to these figures.
Okay. The page with the star that says expressed as a proportion of the statewide average annual wage is the portion that would be put into law. Okay, and it would fall in exactly, all the language would read the same except that these benefit rate classes, factors, and base period wages would read as presented here rather than as it's called. Okay, in order to know what all those funny figures mean, the second change comes into play. And the weekly benefit rate class corresponds with the base period wages converted to dollars and cents, and the benefit amounts converted to dollars and cents rather than factors.
Can you walk us through a couple of examples using these?
What have for example?
Well, a claimant.
Okay. Like a claimant who earns $10,000 would be in rate class 16 and receive a benefit amount of $130.
Okay, so that
whatever his existing benefit.
His existing benefit would range anywhere from $90 to $120.
Now this is again with the suggestion that the dependency allowance be done away with and
yes.
Simply take care of those problems supposedly by the increased benefit schedule in this revision.
It's the department's position that whatever benefit schedule is eventually adopted, that the committee should approach the question as to providing an adequate benefit amount regardless of dependence for the reasons that we went into, I think, in some detail last time, but we really find, and actually we have Doris Simon back with us, who is perhaps more familiar with day-to-day operation, if the committee has any questions of her concerning what our problems are with the dependency allowance, but we would...
Well, we went into that rather extensively at the previous meeting. Now, with one thing that's in your folder that I did receive from the department, and I'm just making sure I understood it, apparently I hadn't understood correctly earlier, that's this document here, which compares the contribution rates under the various proposals. It shouldn't all be in the folder. The center is the current law. On the left is right is, at least it's the original administration proposal. I suppose my next question is, does this change with this new schedule? With regard to the comparison of sponsor substitute for 550, where it changed these new figures, so that the tax base would still be 19,000, I know that wouldn't change. Is that right?
Neither of us have the copy of Wells there, certainly. Does that have a benefits amount on it, or is it just tax?
It gives the tax rate. So why don't you give them a copy of what they have? This would be, as far as the comparison is concerned between various proposals, this would still be true even if the administration bill were changed a second time to reflect the materials you just gave us?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Am I reading this correctly? Is the proposed committee substitute would increase, anybody who's making $10,000 would now get about a 16% increase with the committee substitute, and somebody who's making $25,000 would get about a 50% increase in benefits with the substitute. Is that the way it's working out?
There's nothing on benefits in that, sure.
This is taxes.
Okay. Got you. Okay.
And those figures...
What are the benefits and differences? Or we don't have it to break down in the...
I don't know if we have it item by item. I suppose we could go ahead and maybe have a graph done over this or something to compare them. We can try to have that for Wednesday night's meeting. That would probably be helpful. Well, I think we can do that, and that is to do a chart showing one of these that would show current law, your revised proposal, and the work draft CSO on one page.
The reason I asked that question is I thought the committee substitute did just the opposite, that the rate of increase went down with higher wages. That's right.
I believe it does. That's the most.
Yeah. Let's see. I was reading wrong.
Apparently the amount that an employer would pay in during any one year, from this chart here, the amount that an employer would pay in for the lower or middle income worker would not be all that dissimilar, it seems.
No.
That is 330, 370, 300, and the variations only go up when you get to the fellow who's making $22,000 to $25,000. And that is the amount the employer would pay in 1 year?
Yes. Okay, may I stop and explain something now? This is a comparison of taxes needed for the different proposals. It is a comparison of the average taxes we would need if we had one tax rate for the next 8 years. Okay, it's not necessarily the tax rate we would have next year. It's not necessarily the tax rate we have this year. Obviously, right now we're at 4.0 and 0.8 for the current system. Okay, we may or may not drop to this rate next year, but over the next 8 years, these are the tax rate we would need if we did one tax rate.
This would be the average.
This is the average over the next 8 years.
But there would really be variation. Are there any more questions about the contribution rates that are set for?
Okay, at this point I'd like to come back and explain something I said maybe 2 weeks ago that I believe there was a question on I heard afterwards from the department. I stated that all the proposals in front of us are solvent, and then someone else said our current program may be in trouble. Okay, the difference is, depending upon where your tax base is and where your tax rate is, you'll make the decision as to whether your program is solvent for the benefits you're paying out. Okay, if you increase your benefits and at the same time you increase your tax base to cover all the revenues you would need to fund those benefits, you will not be insolvent. If you tried the proposed committee substitute with a $10,000 tax base, you would be insolvent in 2 years. Okay, so there's that question. Looked at as a whole, each program would itself be solvent.
What was that last, I didn't understand that last statement you made about the $10,000. Say that again.
Okay, if we held the tax base at the current $10,000 level and we raised benefits, okay, without changing the taxes in our existing schedule, we could be insolvent, broke, in 2 years.
Oh, so the example you gave is if we kept the current tax base, but we just went to the benefits in one of the bills.
Right, okay, so I had testified at one point, and then it was sort of a question was raised because someone else had said that we're on thin ground right now and our program is not solvent. They can be solvent if I could pay $500 a week and still have a solvent fund if you were willing to pay the taxes and the tax base that you would need to fund that type of program. Okay, so what you have here again is a balance. You can pay out what you want if you're willing to pay the price to put them in, okay? With the $10,000 tax base, you could fund $240 maximum benefit if you change the taxes a great deal. Okay, it depends upon where you want to go and what you want to do. Does that solve the solvent and solvent question?
Any other questions? Well, I had hoped that about an hour and a half ago we'd be doing what we've been doing right around now, and then we'd be getting into the bills themselves in detail and the pitches for either the Workcraft CS or the administration modified subject or whatever. But it's already 9:30, and there are some matters of concern on the calendar. I'd like to go for a little bit longer if we could get some comments or.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm not closing out right now. It's right. Just that what I'd like is basically maybe some overview comments by the administration on what you have seen of the work draft CS without detail, and then you can get into detail tomorrow night perhaps, and also I think Mr. Carlson might have some remarks going the other way.
What I might suggest is we would prefer to hear the original pitch on the committee substitute so that we don't get jumped to any conclusions. But there is one angle, a small compartmentalized subject, which Rudy Asturias might take this little package of time to address, and that involves the employee refunds, which technically is, I guess it's dropped in the committee substitute, and we have recommended it just makes a fairly tidy little subject rather than get into a whole broad area.
Okay, if you could do that, can you say your name again?
Rudy Asturias, I'm the Chief of Cash Contributions. Under the present law, an employee pays a maximum of $80 to the unemployment insurance fund. This is based on the taxable wage base of $10,000 at 0.8%. If the employee moves from job to job and earns over $10,000, any amount over and above the $80 which has been withheld is returned to the employee upon application for refund. Comparatively, the Alaskan employers are required to pay on a tax of all their employees regardless of the fact that the employee had previously paid or reached the maximum $10,000. I think in this respect, the law was designed as an insurance program requiring the seasonal employer to contribute a higher tax because they produce the highest risk of unemployment. You might relate this to any type of car insurance you have. The more accidents you have, the higher the premium. We believe that this type of insurance concept should also apply to the employee. Employees engaged in seasonal employment has the highest risk of drawing unemployment insurance benefits, and we feel that it's only fair that they are taxed on the same basis as the employer. During the fiscal year 1977, we have processed approximately 15,500 claims to employees. This amounted to approximately $909,000. No funding is actually provided for this type of service that we are giving the employee, either from the feds or the state government.
What do you mean no funding? That is no funding for the administrative costs?
No funding for the administrative costs of this service, yes, sir. We went further and took a 10% at random sampling of over 2,700 claims, which we had received between January 1 and March 13. And this sampling indicated that 62% of the claims filed were from employees related, were filed in were filed by employees in construction-related activities.
That is 60% of the claims.
62%.
Claims for what? Just general claims or claims for the refund?
Claims for the refund, the employee refund itself. And it also revealed that about approximately 61% of the employees actually made $21,000 to $50,000, with 3% making over $50,000. The amount of benefits paid by the state in fiscal year 77 was $73.8 million. Of this amount, $40.1 million was paid to contract construction only, and this makes up 54% of the UI benefits paid. 48% of this went to outside the state.
48% of that 54%?
That's right, sir. Now we feel it not to be equal treatment of our employees who earn $10,000 or less to be actually paying the taxes 100% of their total wages, while the employee who earns $50,000 would not pay after, say, the first quarter. He would reach his maximum $10,000. Or if he had worked for two or more employees, he would be eligible for a claim for refund. And to compound this, or he also is the greatest potential of drawing the benefits on the unemployment insurance program. Some interesting facts came out on the study which Janet had pulled together. Of the total workforce, the average covered employment, contract construction made up 21.1%, paid in approximately $25 million. Employees paid $3 million, $3.8 million. And we paid two contract constructions $40 million. Now, of the total amount, again, I'm reiterating, the total amount of benefits paid during that time, the $40 million was, in fact, 54% of the total benefits paid. The only higher, the rest of the industry actually carried, from the statistics we have here, carried the contract construction. 22% of the workforce was in trade, 21% was in services, Now, they contributed, services contributed 11.3 million contributions, and we paid them 9.7 million in benefits. Trade construction made up 22% of the workforce, paid in 10 million, we paid them 6 million in benefits. So what I'm alluding to here is that the trend is that the rest of the industry seems to be carrying the contract construction, and these are the, again, what I'm trying to point out is, has the highest potential of drawing on the unemployment insurance program. And I think if we're going to, it is our opinion that if they are the highest potential of drawing unemployment insurance, then they should also pay the premium.
Questions?
I have one question.
Yes.
In regards to the employee and employer, I mean, the employee was working more than one place and is entitled to ask for a refund from the second employer, I mean, from the second deal. Is the employer also able to ask for a refund?
No, it is. He is not.
That money just goes right on into the fund, regardless.
That's right, sir. The only situation where an employer would be able to take the employee's wages if they reach the maximum is in a situation where one employer had taken over 100% of the another employer's business within a year, and that the wages are so defined and separable so that they can be transferred. All the employees are transferred from one business to another, and they can pick up the $10,000. That's the only case. Every other case, the employer pays on every employee that he hires. And that's designed by law.
The people that are paying in the least and getting the most, what did you call them, contract construction?
Contract construction.
What is that exactly? What is that?
Comes Jack, can you please?
Research and analysis divides the last economy into sections, which I think are divided by description of job title codes. I'm not sure, but the categories are, to show you maybe what it doesn't include, are agriculture, forestry, and fisheries is one, mining, contract construction, manufacturing, which would be food processing and so forth. Transportation, communications, and public utilities is another single section.
It does not include that?
No. Trade, basically your retail business. Finance, insurance, and real estate. Services, and then a miscellaneous and unclassified section. We could develop for you a rather precise. We just do all of our economic forecasting develop our labor market information for some of these categories.
Chairman, I'd like to get a breakdown of what that means.
Any other questions on this bill?
You can get that information to us Wednesday night. I appreciate it. I don't think we asked for any other materials here relating to the other matter earlier in the meeting. I would like copies of those contracts, and apparently you're providing copies. Mr. Hayes. I wanted to cut the meeting a little short. I have some things I have to do on this one, and I always do too, but Mr. Carlson's been indicating he wanted to make some comments about the presentations here today.
Mr. Chairman, there isn't time for that this morning, but I would like to ask a question of the Research and Analysis Department. I drew up some charts and submitted to the committee based on information given by the Department of Labor. It was my understanding on the 23rd of March in their testimony, they gave the cost factors existing being 4% and 8% to the employee. Now, their chart submitted to the committee today shows that to be 3.7 and 7%. Now, that's a substantial difference. But where I'm concerned, Mr. Chairman, is there now cost figures on the other two pieces of legislation. They show the sponsor substitute for House Bill 550 now being 3.0 and 0.6%. And in their testimony, they said it was 3.3 and 0.7%. And the one that I submitted, they gave the cost figures of 3.7 to the employer and 0.7% to the employee. And what they submitted this morning, they're showing 3.3 for that one and 0.7. And Mr. Chairman, I'm having a little difficulty in trying to explain our cost factors to the people that I represent and to the different legislators if the figures that come from research and analysis aren't constant figures.
Which section, I suppose the short question is, which section do we rely on?
Okay, I have to know what he was talking about. I explained that these figures are different from the ones I've given at other times. Okay, these are an average over the next 8 years. If you'll go back in my face, someone else was talking about here and tell me what the figures on March 23rd were.
Well, they said the average cost down to the employer was 4 and 8.
Come.
Right. This morning says current 3.7 and 7.
Okay, that's what will be for the next 8 years if we had one rate. It is currently 4 for the employer and 0.8 for the employee. Next year it would probably go down. The year after that it may go down and may go up.
But that's what you expect would be an average of all the rates over the next
right,
8 years.
Right, if you had to set one rate for the next 8 years.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I think this document was given in response to your committee staff. I haven't had a chance to review it myself, and I would like, I think what we'd like to do is explain when we testify, if we testify on the committee substitute, something that's parallel.
I understand that, but still we have to have some information. May I at least ask a leading question here? It's my understanding that these are different from previous figures because they involve an approximation that would be an eight-year average rather than the immediate effect or next year's rate or something like that.
But as I remember, the bill is frozen for 2 years on the G schedule or some such. I think the committee should... I think we have to bring in what the effect of the reserve multiple is and what the likely effect would be. I think it requires a lot more detailed explanation.
Okay, this the paper that was passed out today, which everybody received a copy of, is sort of a comparison so that you know, like, I can tell you the tax rates for next year could be anything. If we set it by law, that would go down to the lowest column in the tax table. That looks fine on paper, but that's not what it's going to be, and it's not a good way to do it. Okay, this was a way to compare the three different programs looked at over a general tax rate for the next 8 years, not the specific one for this year or the specific one for next year.
Okay, I'm sure you'll have more detail on that on Wednesday, and committee staff may be getting a hold of you later today to ask you some more information, possibly Mr. Spear also. Okay, we're going to stand in adjournment until 7 p.m. Did you have another question, Mr. Carlson?
7 p.m.
7 p.m. Wednesday.
Well, I don't know what figure we can use when we're talking to the employer. You asked about the cost of the bill. How can I say ours is as cheap now as theirs was originally?
I have the same problem, Mr. Carlson. 7 p.m. Wednesday.